Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is 2019 Blackjack Hall of Fame inductee Rob Wrightson. The Blackjack Ball was several months ago, but it's taken a while for our schedules to mesh. We're happy that this finally happened. Rob Wrightson, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. When and how did you get started playing blackjack?
So I had a girlfriend, and she moved in with these guys that played poker. And I started going to the poker casinos in Los Angeles. That's where I lived. And I asked her to borrow a poker book because I was really interested. I thought, this is the coolest thing ever. This guy makes money playing poker for a living, like the Cincinnati Kid. Steve McQueen was my hero. So I asked her to borrow a book. She came back and gave me the poker book, but it wasn't a poker book. It was a book on blackjack. It was called Playing Blackjack as a Business. And I was really pissed off because I wanted a poker book. Yeah, Lawrence Revere. And so I was like, this is not a poker book. And she goes, well, that's the one I grabbed. So I just said, okay, screw it. And I started learning how to play blackjack. And that's how it all started.
So it's all her fault.
It is her fault. I wonder where she is now.
And now you moved to Vegas at some point then, right? How old were you at this point?
I was in my early 20s. Yeah.
And then what made you decide to move to Vegas? The blackjack?
Well, I practiced over, I learned the strategy in the book. And then in Revere's book, it says somewhere in the back, if you pay $200 for the strategy, you will learn the advanced point count. You'll fly around the world with first class, eat nothing but gourmet meals, and return home showing a profit. And at the time, I was going to school and working at Jack in the Box, so it sounded pretty good.
Yeah, the part that I liked about those books is that with the comps, you would women would love to come to Las Vegas with you and enjoy these free gourmet rooms with you, and all she did was play a few hours a day at a game where you had the advantage. And that's the part I signed up for. I didn't work out quite that way, but that's what I signed up for.
So you learned from Revere as well?
I read Revere, and that particular quote was from probably Million Dollar Video Poker by Houston.
You mean Million Dollar Blackjack?
Dollar Video Poker might be by me. Yeah Million Dollar Blackjack.
Freudian slip. But so you learned, you decided to be
right
here. How big was your bankroll?
I built it up to $600. I started at 150 and built it up to 600.
And so you literally moved here with $150.
I literally grabbed a friend of mine who worked at a furniture store, and I said, dude, we got to do this. I went and picked him up. He goes, no, I can't leave the furniture store. I said, come on. I threw him into my Toyota, and we drove to Las Vegas and started playing blackjack.
And did he continue playing as well?
Yes. He went on to be a professional player and then got into the slot teams.
Wow.
His name is Dan.
Probably still is.
Yeah.
Oh, Dan that played with Jim?
Yeah.
Yes. I know who Dan is.
Yeah. If it wasn't for me, Dan would still be working in the furniture store.
The furniture store. Uh-huh.
What did it mean to you to be voted into the Hall of Fame by your peers?
It was a very touching moment for me. It meant a lot to me. I mean, I worked really hard at learning how to play blackjack. I mean, in those days, we didn't have the knowledge that, simple counts performed almost just as well as, high-level counts. So, the Revere count was a four-level count, and I learned all 160-some matrix numbers. And so I put a lot of time into it and a lot of effort. And then... took a lot of different paths, turns, and got into electronics and other ways of beating the games. And so that, just being acknowledged for that, just like I said, I think I almost started to cry.
Yeah, you did. You teared up. It was a very emotional speech.
You had a Hall of Fame acceptance speech that Max Rubin implied was slightly shorter than War and Peace. Among many others, you credited Claude Shannon with helping you. Now, I only know Shannon from his 50s work in Bell Labs with John Kelly, leading up to the Kelly Criterion. And Shannon was this tinkerer with all kinds of gambling toys that he worked on. But I'm not familiar with how Shannon's work is otherwise noted for blackjack players. How did he help you?
Well, first of all, I mean, the speech was no more than 2 hours, so I don't know what he's talking about, because there's no way you can read that book in 2 hours. Yeah, so why did I credit him, Shannon? Well, in poker, you want to maximize your information gain and simultaneously minimize the loss of information in your hand, and also maximize your expectation. So to put it in terms of information theory, in poker you want to maximize your gain of information from your opponents while simultaneously maximizing your range, which would be your entropy. So that's why I credited him, because I worked so hard on poker.
So that was more for poker than blackjack?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Tell us about core.
Okay. So how you in terms of how it started, what we did.
Yeah, let's go back to the
beginning.
You
want to go back to the beginning of core?
When gambling first came into California, the Indians right. got gambling, but they weren't allowed to bank the games.
Correct, right.
So even the ones that are now full casinos back then could not.
So my partner was a guy named Daryl Myers. I'm sure you guys know him or heard of him. And Daryl had a very serious injury to his back. So he couldn't play at all. So it was just the two of us. And I was going out trying to play. And at the same time, you know, trying to help Daryl. And he was basically bedridden. He had a surgery that he just had done. On his lower back, and so it was a low time. We'd, you know, money just had dwindled by that point. And so a friend of mine called and he said, "Hey man, I was just out at this casino by Morongo or out that way, and they have these player banks. You should come check it out." So I did. I went out there and it was good. It was really good. You had this opportunity to bank the games yourself, so I called Daryl, put him in the car. He couldn't really play, but he walked into the casino with me, and we got a hotel room and we stayed there. And I just started banking the games, and that's how it started. Yeah.
And it went from that to you guys hiring people to sit at all the tables and banking all up and down the state of California.
Exactly. It kind of blew up. There was already bankers in there, but then there was banker wars. And then there was one banker that kind of had the high tables. And his name was Rick. And so he's standing behind me. Oh, and he's standing behind me and he says, "What's your name?" I said, "My name is Reed." And he says, "Ah, Reed, as in Rob Wrightson." I'm like, "Who the hell is this guy?" So he goes, "Can we talk?" So I said, "Sure." So I get up from the table and we go over to the corner. And at this time, our bankroll is pretty small. You know, we're just getting started again. Daryl was sick. And he's like, "You know, I've known who you are for years. I used to watch you do some cut games, and we used to hide behind the pillars to try to figure out what you guys were doing." I said, and I remember these like four boneheads hiding, and every time I turn around, I said, these they can't be security. And he says, "Yeah, and I don't want to go buck heads with you. I don't want to buck heads with you." And I'm saying, I think that's a wise decision. So we partnered up with him, which was great because he had a fairly large bankroll then, at least compared to us. And that's how it came about. And then we started Core a couple years later.
So you start core, you start expanding.
And, yes.
I mean, for listeners, they're probably going to find this hard to believe, but back then the casinos would pay you to bank as opposed to you having to pay them commissions.
Correct.
And things like that. Like,
yes.
They needed the liquidity, so they needed somebody with a bankroll to
I remember the first time we realized we were banking here in California. We opened up an office, and the casino called. It was like Christmas, or it was a holiday, and the casino manager called and says, "There's no bankers here. Can you send someone in?" And he says, "Well, we need you here. Basically, we'll pay." And so we worked out a contract, and that's how it started. We're like, "We can get money for this too."
Yeah.
this is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
So
now you get a call to go bank at Sequent, and ran into some problems there.
Right. Yeah. So we got a call from the management at Sequent, and they had this really cockamamie story that something like, "We have a high roller in here, and he scares all the local bankers. We need a professional banker like you guys to come in here. He sits down, he does crazy things. He'll double down on hard 17, or he'll hit hard 17 and sometimes catch a 3 or 4. You know how it is. You're a professional." I'm like, "Oh, sure. Yeah, that sounds strange." And he says, "So they don't want to take his action. But, you know, so we're getting rid of them, and we want a professional organization like CORE to come down here." And so I go in and talk to my partner, and Daryl's like, "It just sounds like BS, Bobby. I mean, they're a bunch of cheats." I'm like, "Yeah, but let's go down and check it out, and let's see if I can, you know, see what they're up to." So we went down to Sequent.
So what were they up to?
Oh, you guys want to hear that part?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so we go down to Sequent. The first night, I'm sitting at the table, and everything seems kind of normal, and I did notice that the dealer at Sequent wasn't quite squaring up the cards. So the one card is, you can see like a little bit of the side of the card. Just wasn't quite
under
squared
the whole
up.
Card.
Just wasn't quite squared up. But I didn't register too much, but it did register because I was looking at every little detail. I played, nothing happened, and the next night I went back. And they brought the same dealer over to me, and she started doing that again. And all of a sudden, the guy that they're talking about, the high roller, comes up with the cowboy hat on. He's like, "Hey, you know," and he starts playing, and I'm watching, and he starts making weird plays. So then I stood up to look at the corners of the card, you know, that she's not squaring up, and he keeps saying, sit down, you're making me nervous." So I keep standing up, and I started to find a pattern on the side of the cards where I could tell if it's a small card. So I saw that, I reached over, that she didn't square up, I saw that it was a small card. I reached over, I grabbed her card and flipped over. I said, "Five or less," and I flipped over the card, turned it over, and it was a 4, I think. And she starts yelling, pit boss starts yelling. The guy, I turned to the guy, I said, "You're a cheat." And he goes, and he just gets up and leaves with his buddy. So they just walk out. And that the casino manager who wanted me there goes, "You can't do that. You can't grab the cards." I go, "They're cheating. I mean, I did you a favor." And
unless he was in.
Yes. So I said, "Hold that deck. Keep that. Wrap it up." They said, we wrapped it all up in plastic. So I went the next day to the security room, and I said, "I want to go through that deck, that seems, and I'm going to show the guy who's in charge of protecting the games that I can read these cards, that I can at least tell small, big, and or tens and very small cards." And he grabs the thing. It was wrapped up in plastic. He grabs it. The date's on it. Everything looks fine. And I start to show him, but it's embarrassing because I can't read any of the cards now. It's just random. So I'm like, "Are you sure this is from the table I played?" He says, yes. And I'm just like, so all of a sudden a light bulb goes off. So I said, "I was here the night before, and he didn't play at my game, but that same dealer came, I think, waiting for him to come, and she was not scoring up the cards. Can we see those cards from that date? So the night before, he brings those, and then I can start reading them, and I'm showing them, and he was just, he's in shock. He's amazed. So that's how, then that's when the shit hit the fan.
Yeah, I remember you telling me at the, when we first talked about this, that that story would have scared a lot of people out of banking, if not just there, then in general. But your attitude was, you know, this is supposed to be our business. This is what we're supposed to be experts at. And part of our job is spotting this stuff, and we just have to be smarter than they are.
Right.
Which obviously was the right attitude, because ultimately made you a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, after you pointed this out to Siquan, did that make you more attracted to them, or they didn't want anything to do with you because you took away their money train?
They wanted nothing to do with me. Yeah, yeah.
So they were in on it. Probably.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know how high it went up, but obviously at least the dealer was in on it. And at least someone was in on it to where I'm going to sit. They would bring that dealer in.
Right, yeah.
And high enough to be able to switch the cards.
Yeah.
I mean, did you run into a lot of this because you did this for years in many different casinos. Did you run into a lot of this kind of cheating?
No, I can't say no. I would say no.
I've heard a lot of banker stories where the guy who's doing the banking needs to take a 5-minute break to go to the restroom. And when he gets back, whoever was taking his place goes, you know, you just wouldn't believe it. This guy just came and he won $10,000 and just left. Just all when you were that 5 minutes at the bathroom. And that would happen several times. Did anything like that ever happen?
You're asking me if someone came, won a bunch of money and then left?
Well, no, while you were not there watching it happen. That particular story, I have a friend who banked Paigao Tiles. And he's an expert at catching that kind of stuff. And he would be there watching the game. Everything would be fine. You know, eventually he has to go to the bathroom. While he's in the bathroom, somebody hits him for $10,000.
I see.
Comes back out. And he said, you know, we just can't.
So I wasn't my job really for the team wasn't to be a banker. So I hardly did any banking. I would only bank in situations like that, where it was like I wanted to check out the game, or I would go to the casinos and stand behind our players if I thought there was some shenanigans going on.
Yeah.
We did get hit on Paigao. I do know that. But
Paigao Tiles.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Or Paigao Poker. I know we got hit on that.
All right. Back to playing. It has nothing to do with me, but tell me about Negative Bob.
Okay, sure, yeah. So there was a place in Las Vegas called the Barbary Coast. I don't know, is it still here or it's gone?
No, it's now called the Cromwell.
The Cromwell, okay. So the Barbary Coast was like, it was one of the worst places for a card counter to play. So I like I said, I purchased the $200 card counting system from Lawrence Revere. I learned it. I came up. I played at the Barbary Coast. Literally, I got barred within 15, 20 minutes. And I was beside myself. I was so angry that I got ripped off from the system. I called up Mary Revere, who is his daughter, and I said, this thing doesn't work. I've spent all these hundreds and hundreds of hours of practicing and doing this, and I just arrived to Vegas. I'm barred. And she says, did you play at the Barbary Coast? I said, yes. How did you know? She goes, don't play there. So it was a place.
Yeah, play at the El Cortez. They can handle lots of action.
She mentioned that. She said, two places don't play, El Cortez, Barbary Coast.
Yeah. We used to send new players in just to get that first barring
out of the way. Yes, right. Yeah, so So it was always a joke, you know, let's go to the Barbary Coast and play, you know, or if someone wanted to get bar. In fact, the guy that did the Esquire article, Michael Angeli, he wanted to see what it's like to get barred. I said, okay, we'll go to the Barbary Coast. and I signaled him how to play. But so because of that, when it was April Fool's Day, we came up with this crazy idea that I wonder if the Barbary Coast, I think it was Wally and I, Wally Simmons, we were saying, I wonder if the Barbary Coast would bar you if you did everything the opposite. So it's obvious you know what to do. So you'd put big money out on, you know, negative counts, small money out or sit out on positive counts. What would they do? And so
what would they do?
Okay, all right. I was waiting for that. So we printed out on this old dot matrix printer a strategy of all the matrix numbers. But then we reversed the matrix numbers on the strategy, and I believe it was all of it. Bill Benter was there, Wally, myself, I think Dan Laporte, and some other guys from the team. And I sat down with the paperwork, and I'm like going through it like this. I buy in, and I said, "Excuse me, waitress, I would like a." Scotch and soda, and then I lean forward. I go, hold the scotch. Okay, like I was doing everything like a card counter would do, but like a bonzo card counter, you know. And she goes, just scotch and soda, and no scotch. I go, yeah, scotch and soda. Hold the scotch, loud enough for everyone to hear. So I start playing. She brings over just the soda, and the count goes up. The count goes way up, and I have all the stack of blacks, and I go like this. I go, hold on. And I take that big sheet with matrix numbers out, and I look, and I grab the big stack of black, and then I just put like a red chip in the middle. And it's, so that went on for a while, just doing the opposite of everything until they just lost their shit and threw us out. I remember we were chased.
You couldn't have been winning.
No, I don't even remember if I won or lost. It was the fun of it. That's the, you know, I got more enjoyment out of it, but they chased us out. I remember, I think Bentner and I went into an elevator and some guy comes running up and says he's going to split our heads like watermelons and the doors close. I mean, it was pretty crazy how mad they got. It was just an April Fool's joke.
Some people have no sense of humor sometimes. Now, in the next story, I want to tell our audience that it happened in Bob Stupak's place, and Rob asked Richard and I if Stupak was still alive, and we said no, he died several years ago, and Rob says, great, I can tell the whole story. So
let's hear it.
Yeah, okay, so I was pulled up at the California Club, and I couldn't play. We had a little system where we were, you know, hooked up to a camera, and so I was pulled up there. I couldn't play. I was arrested, and Daryl and John Wayne kept going, and they wound up at Stupex, and John Wayne was wearing all this equipment. They got pulled up and back-roomed, and they're talking to Stupak, and Stupak is basically negotiating an amount of money that they can pay him to not, you know, call the gaming commission. And so they're kind of working out the amount when a security guard is tugging at John Wayne's, you know, chest and saying, what's this? What is that? What is that? What is that? Is that a bomb? And the Duke says, well, I mean, if it was, I don't think any of us would be here now the way you're pulling at the wires and everything. And then that was it. That's, you know, all hell broke loose. He called the bomb squad. They came down. Stupak was really upset. He's like, man, now that's out of my control. You guys, you know, you guys are going, you know, are going to get arrested here, and it's out of my control. I was, you know, working something out. But Stupak did manage to take $7,000 in chips that we didn't get back. But so that's the Stupak bomb threat story.
Wait, wasn't there some chase or something that happened? Or
oh yeah, but that's not the yeah that comes after. Okay, yeah, you want that one? Okay, yeah, sorry. So you just got to refresh me. So we get arrested, or they get arrested. They go down. I go down to bail them out. We bail out the two of them, and I'm in the parking lot downtown by the courts. And as they're coming out, John and Daryl, we see Wally coming to his car in the parking lot. And he's with the team that he was working with at the time. And he says, hey, we all were roommates. He says, oh, my roommates are here. I'll just get a ride with them. Now, this project that we were doing with the equipment was a secret project. And so we didn't tell our wives or girlfriends, and we didn't tell Wally, even though we were all living together. It was a completely secret project. And so we get in the car, and he's like, hey, guys, what are you doing here? And we go, well, what are you doing here? Well, he goes, oh, I'm going through a lawsuit right now here with, you know, something. And so we start driving, and we're going back to the house. But one of us notices that it seems like we're being followed. And we look back, and that car that was following us is no longer there. It's replaced by a kind of a soccer mom car with a woman driving it. And Duke and I are going, we're being followed. And Wally's like, hey, man, what are you talking? Why would anyone be following us? You know, and we can't really tell them what's going on. And so we start driving out on the 15 going towards Los Angeles, you know, heading south. And he's like, well, what are you doing? We're supposed to be going home. We're going, oh, we just want to make sure we're not being followed. We turn off, and there's a Centel truck on the side of the road. And I get out of the car. And I just talked to the Centel driver for a few minutes. I get back in the car, and as we drive away, I see a whole bunch of cars converge on the Centel guy. So now we know for sure we're being followed. There's a helicopter up there. We pull off onto this tarmac area of this old airport.
By Sloan. There's a runway.
There's some runway out there. We see a guy drinking beer. Looks like beer, like Michelob beer. And then Daryl looks and says, that's not beer. That's like a fake beer bottles. It's binoculars. So Daryl goes and he smacks the back of the guy's car to say, you know, who the hell are you guys? He smacks the back of the car. The next thing, I mean, within seconds, we're surrounded, the helicopter swirling, people are running out. Guns drawn, saying, get down on the ground, get down on the ground. They throw Daryl. They were actually kind of stomping on Daryl. And we were on the ground, and there was this woman with a revolver. And the hammer was back, and she's shaking. She's so scared. And she's pointing at the gun at Duke and I and Wally. And it was madness, and we're on the – on the tarmac, I look at Duke, and I go, hey, Duke, I think this blackjack thing wasn't such a good idea after all. And so they took us all to jail. They grabbed me, and they said, why did you beat up that police officer? And I'm like, I don't know. I just did too many Wheaties. It just didn't just BS. And they took Duke and Daryl. And then we all went back to jail for I was arrested for obstruction and beating up a police officer. All those charges were just dropped. But
wow,
so that was kind of crazy.
Vegas was kind of a crazy place back then.
Right.
This is the 80s, right?
Yeah.
When bad stuff still happened.
We're going to take a brief break. South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. The May promotion of the month is $500,000 swipe, spin, and win. On Mondays through Thursdays, play 300 points between 3 a.m. and 11:30 p.m. and spin the wheel. Prizes include free play up to $50, bonus points, $25 resort cards, and food coupons of various amounts. After you play, stop by the kiosk and spin the virtual meal wheel. On Memorial Day, Monday, May 27th, every 3 minutes between 8 a.m. and midnight, some player receives $100 in free play. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Lucky Eights. This is a rare case where a video poker game has the same name as a table game side bet. It's a 10 coins per line game where you get bonuses for three or more eights, including full houses with three eights. If you get dealt trips or higher about every 35 hands, you get to spin the virtual wheel, including amounts ranging from 188 coins to, occasionally, 18,888. Induces wild variations. You spin the wheel on dealt flushes or higher, which occur every 42 hands on average. You'll need to figure out the strategy for yourself, but it appears to be possible with simple algebra. With 88445 in double-double bonus, it must be correct just to hold the eights, because the bonus you get on three or more eights induces wild variations where you would normally hold a suited jack 10-9 over a pair of eights. In this game, surely it's better to hold the eights.
Okay, so I want to talk about, there was an article in Esquire magazine back in the 90s called The Hammer. And it was about an escapade with you here in Las Vegas with Emilio Estevez and winning $500,000 in a weekend here in Vegas. How did that whole thing come about?
Yeah, so there's a club in Beverly Hills called the Havana Room, and I'd go there maybe once every 2 weeks. I was a member at the time, and I met a guy named Jonathan Branstein, who at the time worked as a producer for Avatar Entertainment, which I believe was Emilio's production company at Disney. And they had a couple picture deal there. And so the fight was coming up. And since I was a high roller at the time, I could get tickets to the fight. So I got, I got like 20 tickets to the fight, and I invited 20 of my closest friends. And one of them was this guy from the Havana Room. And we all went up, and during that trip, he watched me play blackjack, and he was just amazed. He said that, dude, every hand you play is my mortgage, you know? This is incredible. There's such a story here. I work at Avatar, and I'd like to introduce you to, Emilio and his family, and I work for him, and maybe there's something here. So I said, sure, let's talk. And next trip, we set up another trip like a month later, and he was telling Emilio and the Sheen clan how the rooms that I got were so incredible. It was like the Rain Man suite. But it turns out when I invited the whole gang up for the next trip, it was Super Bowl weekend. And so I'm expecting the Rain Man suite like I always get. And I get like a room, you know, just like a room, like a Motel 6 room at Caesars, you know. I'm like, oh, no. So I go to my host. I go, no, I need like five of these. I get these guys coming, you know, from L.A. And he's like, well, I don't know what I can do. It's like, it was extremely embarrassing. I talked my way into getting two or three rooms. Maybe one was like an executive suite and the others were just regular rooms. And they came and they were very nice about it. Martin left immediately to go stay at the MGM. But Emilio was like, hey man, that's fine. I don't care. And so we
Now, there was a journalist along with you, too.
Yeah, to Michael Angeli. And he later became a writer on that show with the Cylons.
Show with the
Battlestar Galactica. Oh, yeah, yeah. And so he came along with us. And the plan that Bernstein had was, let's go. He'll document something, write about something, and then they'll get a movie deal. That was the plan. But the plan was also not to put my name in the article. That was the agreement. It would just be this fake name of some guy. So we had dinner together, and then we all went down and played. And the interesting thing during the dinner is I wasn't really I think Emilio's bullshit detector went off. I think he thought, okay, this is bullshit. This is not real. This is, you know, this guy's full of it. And so we're not really kind of hitting it off. We're kind of like, and so there was a disconnect. And we went to play, started playing. And by the end of the evening, Emilio kept coming over and watching. And Bernstein was there, and the crews were there. At the end of the evening, I went a little over, 500,000. And in the elevator, I remember we're going up, and I just got the cash, and we went out with the security. And
that was back in the day when you could cash out $200,000 or $500,000.
So I just got the cash, and I had already instructed these guys, don't talk in the elevator, don't talk in the hallways, don't talk about anything on the phone. And we go into the room, and Emilio just turns to me and he says, "Dude, I thought you were full of shit." He goes, "You're the fucking real deal." so we bonded, and then Emilio and I started going on trips together to Vegas.
So he would be Pete for you.
Yeah, he's also a very, very good player himself. Yeah. So
I heard once that the Irish folk dancing guy be Pete for you too,
Michael Flatley.
Oh, is that yes. True? Yeah, that is true. Yes, Michael Flatley, the Lord of the Dance. Yeah, Michael was a BP for me on several plays.
And that was before Lord of the Dance ever.
Yeah, so he was always a talented guy, and he would play. He was working occasionally with a band called the Chieftains, and I saw he did a Hollywood Bowl once, but no, it was obviously not the success that he eventually became, and he was a good BP.
And my understanding is you used to tell him, drop that dancing stuff. There's no money in dancing.
I did. I got hoisted on my own petard with that. Yeah. So when
he did okay.
Yeah. So when he, as a funny story, when he invited us to his show, when he came to LA, Duke and I, because Duke and I, we, the three of us did a lot of blackjack play together. And he invited us to the Universal Amphitheater to see his show. And after the show, he took us backstage, and there was a party, and I mean, it was pretty spectacular. It was a huge bathtub for him, and celebrities were there. Barbara Streisand was in the back room. There was just like a big party in his very large room that he had at Universal. And we're having a great time, and he's introducing us as his old friends and this. In the old days, Duke and Rob. And I made a self-effacing joke, and I said, "Well, I told you to stick with your old job in Chicago." The next thing I know, Duke and I were kind of like pushed out the back door by the security guards. It was kind of funny, but yeah. So yeah, he's done quite well.
You and some friends studied Limit Hold'em, Heads Up Limit Hold'em, I think.
Correct. Yes.
When did this happen, and how good did you get?
So I started working on poker after reading I guess it goes back to the second part of the story where I had my girlfriend go back and actually get a poker book from the same guy. His name was Richard Beale. He was he later became my roommate, and he gave me a book by a guy named Norman Zeta, who I think Norman wrote the very best book on poker, at least up until recently. But his book is incredible, and so I hooked up with Norman, started working with him and talking to him and just learning all about game theory and poker, and eventually solved the unequal contest. And I thought I was the only person in the world that solved the when it's a head up game and the distributions are skewed. I thought I was the only person that solved it, and then I met someone else. I posted seven equations on a rec gambling board in 1994 or five, maybe somewhere around there. No, I guess it was before that, or right around that time, anyway. And I got probably about 40 responses, and one of the responses was from a PhD by the name of Dr. Hane Hundahl out of Penn State, and he was a professor there. And we started talking, and on the phone we're talking, and he says, well, I've worked out something when the distributions are unequal. And it scared the hell out of me. It was like, wait, I thought I was the only person that knew this. So I just blurted out the formula because my ego wouldn't let me say after the fact that oh, yeah, I knew that. I already knew the answer to that because I figured he wouldn't believe me. And so that's how I hooked up with Hane, and Hane and I then went on to solve heads up limit hold'em.
So you guys solved limit hold'em when? What year?
That's a really good question, but it's going to be I'm going to say it was pretty much solved in the 90s. I think we have a patent for it in the 90s, but it's somewhere there. But years before, like Alberta.
Yeah, this hit national news like a couple of years ago that these guys in Alberta had solved heads up limit hold'em, and you guys had basically done it 20 years ago.
Yeah, we did it. I'd say we did it 12 years. Now, see, we used to play our bot against their bot. You know, their best bot would come out. We would just destroy it, and then, so they were several years behind us.
Yeah. So, but coming from a gambling background, you did what I think is the smart thing. You went out and made tons and tons of money with this information. So, and I remember I went to interview you. I was going to do an interview you with Blackjack Forum. Back when Blackjack Forum was still being printed.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to your house in Brentwood.
Mm-hmm.
And there were all these girls that were coming in, you know, to go work in the back room. And I remember you saying to me, and I think this was late 90s or, mm-hmm. you know, and I remember you saying poker is the future. You know, poker is where the money is.
Mm-hmm.
And so you guys trained these girls how to play limit hold'em and
yes,
made nine figures.
Well, we don't need to discuss money,
okay, but an awful lot of money. But I remember one of the other things I thought was interesting was the girls started getting accused of being bots.
Correct. Yeah,
and one in particular I remember had to put up a webcam to show that she was actually the one playing. But can you describe the clocks on the wall?
Sure. Yeah. So the one you're talking about is Larry Kennedy. It's Poker Girl was her handle on the online sites. She was accused. Just a quick backstory. I met her. She was a bartender at Arnie Morton's restaurant. So she went from bartender at Arnie Morton's restaurant to one of the best poker players in the world using the strategy. So, yeah. So she, we designed a system to that we would put like a clock second hand through a CD because it had the hole there, and then the strategy for each particular bucket of the game they're in, we broke it down to these individual buckets. So wherever section they were in, they would look at that particular clock, and they'd look at the secondhand dial, and it would tell them at how to play it. So it would randomize the strategy.
So there'd be one for before the flop, one for after the flop.
Yeah, but there was many more than that.
Yeah.
So there was there was 16, 25 discs. I don't recall at this time.
So it was kind of like a blackjack basic strategy.
Exactly like that. So all they had to know, well, eventually they kind of got it down really well. And we also had software that they could play against and learn from as well. But the software was a problem because, they would confiscate your money if they detected you were using a bot. And so then that gets into the whole cat and mouse game of, is the mouse moving like a human would? You know, is it too Gaussian? Is it you want to have some biases for each individual? You know, so it looks like a different person playing it, but the same person if it's, you know, here. So you'd have to actually have some styles to it. So it got very complicated, and it wasn't necessary. So we used that as a trainer, and then we developed these probability discs that the players would use.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. But then once online poker got shut down, that kind of killed things, right?
Yeah, and then we had money taken from the girls from the sites that claimed that they had to be robots. So, and they weren't. And we had cameras hooked up in their while they played to show that they weren't robots, but they still kept the money.
When you say you had a patent on it, when it was published a few years ago, was this a patent infringement?
So it was more than a few years ago that we have the patent. The patent that we could just look up right now what year, but there were several patents. The original patent was, I believe it was the Equal Contest. Originally it was the Equal Contest, and then we had a patent for a slot machine, a game, sort of first heads up poker game. I think we won like a best gold medal at a show. This was, I believe, in 96 or 97.
Someone else later came out with a machine that would play Hold'em. But that was not yours, right?
Well, ours was. This is about the time that Core was breaking up, and we had formed a company called GameCraft, which my partner Daryl. So I licensed the patent. It was signed over. I would get royalties, but we split up Core, and so GameCraft went on and developed these slot machines, and we had them in. In several casinos, but that was, I think it was just before the time, and I do believe that there could be some patent infringements, but it's really hard to fight that when you know you're going against a behemoth like that, and
very interesting. Rob Wrightson, it's a pleasure to have you on the air. Congratulations again about being in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. We appreciate you spending time with us. Richard, thank you. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.